The Forum on Workplace Inclusion's 2021 podcast series is sponsored by Best Buy. More diversity in tech means more ideas that can change the world. Learn more at bestbuy.com/moreofthis. If you enjoyed the Forum on Workplace Inclusion podcast, check out our monthly webinar series sponsored by the Walton Family Foundation. The Forum on Workplace Inclusion webinar series are free monthly webinars offering professional and organizational skill-building opportunities in diversity, equity, and inclusion topics featuring presenters from industries around the globe. Learn more about our webinar series and to register for upcoming webinars at forumworkplaceinclusion.org/webinar. Donate to the Forum. We get to engage people, advance ideas, and ignite change because of the generous support from our community. If you find our resources meaningful or valuable, please consider supporting the Forum today. Visit forumworkplaceinclusion.org/donate. That's forumworkplaceinclusion.org/donate. Thank you very much for your support and generosity. With that, I'd like to say thank you to all our listeners and subscribers. You help support the growth of the podcast and reach new listeners. If you like what you're hearing on the Forum podcast, please consider writing a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to your podcasts. If you've already written a review, thank you. Please consider sharing our podcast with a friend, family member, or a colleague you think might find value in the content. Word of mouth is the best way the Forum grows, so thank you very much for listening and sharing. Thanks again, and enjoy the show.
Hello, and thank you for tuning into the Forum on Workplace Inclusion podcast series brought to you by Best Buy. I'm Ben Rue, Program Manager here at the Forum. We're really looking forward to today's podcast, How to Communicate So People See the System, with Manal Bapaya of Brevity and Wit. If data and logic was enough to change people's minds, we wouldn't be arguing about climate change. There's a lot that behavioral science can tell us about how we can communicate about diversity, equity, and inclusion in a way that gets past people's defenses and really moves the needle on the issue. Unfortunately, most DEI practitioners are unaware of the power of framing and strategic communications. In this podcast, Manal Bapaya, founder of strategy and design firm Brevity and Wit, will discuss key insights from social science, particularly psychology, on how audiences hear our messages and why they need to see the system if we really want things to change. Find out what works and what doesn't. This episode will make you question your assumptions about the power of storytelling and the importance of communications in creating inclusive cultures. The podcast will help you understand what framing and strategic communications are and how it relates to advancing DEI, learn the biggest obstacle to getting audiences to get on board with racial equity, and discover how you can frame your DEI initiative for greater adoption. Manal Bapaya is a strategic consultant with nearly 20 years of professional experience. Her areas of expertise include human-centered design, behavior change, psychology, and principles of diversity, equity, and inclusion as they relate to media, marketing, and communications. As the founder and principal consultant of Brevity and Wit, Manal is passionate about designing for equity. Her work includes a holistic rebranding of Evans Consulting, a human-centered management consulting firm, and working with NPR's news' managers to design a system of diversifying news sources. As a marketing strategist, she is responsible for a 1,450% increase in website traffic and 50% increase in event revenues for Cook Ross, a diversity and inclusion consulting firm. Her clients also include PBS Kids, the International Center for Research of Women and in Gender Health. Manal has a BA in English from Bowdoin College, a master's degree in clinical psychology from Fordham University, and was formally trained in organizational development and change leadership at Georgetown University. In 2016, she was selected as a digital production fellow by Organizing for Action, the nonprofit advocacy group started by President Barack Obama. She is an advisory board member for Bring Change to Mind, the nonprofit started by actress Glenn Close and her sister Jessie Close to end mental health stigma. She lives with her family in Silver Spring, Maryland. Hi, Manal. It is such a pleasure to have you here. Thank you so much for being part of our 2021 podcast series and talking about this very, very important subject.
It's my pleasure, Ben. Thank you for having me.
Yes, it's our pleasure, really. And yeah, equity is so important. Well, it's funny how like this industry is constantly changing. When I started at the forum here a couple of years ago, it was just about DEI, just diversity and inclusion. And it's just recently been where equity has been added. And there is this debate on what's the most important. And you know, I've also seen accessibility added as well, and belonging. So there's just a lot for people to learn. And even for people in the industry, there's so much that's constantly moving. So I really appreciate you coming here and taking the time to really explain all of this to us.
It's my pleasure. As I say in my book, you know, equity has often been the middle child of DEI.
Yes.
The concept we all skip over to get to those warm, fuzzy feelings of inclusion. And I get it, because equity is really about systems and structures and policies mm-hmm. and things that make our head hurt. But it's actually really fundamental and critical and what I'm most passionate about, obviously, as my book title says.
Yes. I was going to say congratulations on the new book.
Thank you. Thank you. I know. I'm very excited for it.
Yeah. As are we. And you mentioned the quote on the back of your new book, how even the most passionate advocates of diversity, equity, and inclusion have been known to treat equity as the middle child, the skip over to get to the warm fuzzies, which is the diversity and inclusion. But why? So let's start there. Why do you think equity is so ignored in the DEI space?
I think that it is a bit of a hard concept to grasp. Mm-hmm. It is very abstract. And it is not really feelings-based. You know, I think most DEI consultants are exceptionally emotionally intelligent mm-hmm. and seem to like existing in that feeling space, which is really critical for the work and, you know, on one side. But, you know, the equity part of it is really looking at systems. And I don't think that most of us were raised or were educated in a way to be able to see the system.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, the research has even borne this out. Brevity and Wit, the company that I've founded, we do a lot of work in communications. And the communications research has found that one of the biggest obstacles to diversity, equity, and inclusion is this belief in rugged individualism. And so when people are presented with disparities between two groups, whether it's racial or otherwise, people tend to attribute those differences, those disparities, to individual effort or agency, because people don't understand how the system is working and how it leads to those disparities, because we have been raised to believe that somehow the system is neutral and it's all based on our effort, which is not really the full story.
Definitely. And I mean, that makes me think of all the hoopla or all the issue being brought up over critical race theory. It's like people getting so upset just about talking about how the systems are different and like set up to benefit others more than, you know, some more than others.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think we communicate that very well. And so what the research has shown is, if you start by talking about disparities, people first get their defenses up and mm-hmm. attribute those differences, like I said, to individual effort. Yeah. So what you really need to do when you're framing diversity, equity, inclusion, or issues around diversity, equity, inclusion, either in your organization or in society at large, is to start by showing people the system. You can't start with the narrative of how, and often this happens in journalism, of this narrative of this one individual that embodies the injustice, either because they're working so hard and not getting anywhere, or they've worked really hard and overcome all these obstacles in order to get somewhere. Neither, like, starting your narrative with any of those individual stories does not help this effort. What you really need to start with is showing people the system, and then people can start to deduce, oh, well, there's probably some places where the system isn't working really well or breaking down. And then you can bring in, you know, how the system is disproportionately affecting marginalized groups and how it may not be serving them well.
What's leadership role in that?
Yeah. So leadership has two roles when it comes to shaping the narrative around equity. There's there's a role you play when you're talking about yourself, and there's a role when you play when you're talking about issues that are external to you. So what I just described is what leaders should do when they're talking about issues external to them. If you want to frame your DEI work in your organization, you need to start by shared values, and then start by explaining how this organization works and where it is sort of breaking down and not working well for some people, and then how you're going to address that. Right. And so that gets into actually knowing how your organization works or knowing how the system works, which sometimes people don't spend enough time really digging into that. Right. Like, it's really easy to get outraged about disparities without doing the deep work of figuring out why those disparities are happening, you know?
Yeah.
So organizations and leaders particularly need to do that deep study of their own systems and organizations in order to be able to communicate that to their employees. On the other side of the coin is how leaders talk about themselves.
Yes.
And how they talk about, and even how they talk about the organization's success. And one of the things that I've started really working with leaders on is being able to reframe your story of success in a way that unmasks the system for others. So what do I mean by this? So I often tell the story about how my parents came to this country with $20, one suitcase, and my mother was pregnant with me. And they ended up in Greenpoint, Brooklyn, working during the height of the racist war and crime in New York, where my father, who had previously done a residency in England, where most of the emergency room admissions were appendicitis, when he came to New York, most of them were gunshot wounds, which was real culture shock for him.
Yeah, I bet.
My mother tells stories about, you know, they had to have a security guard walk the residents from one building to another because out of 120 residents, 60 had been mugged by people living with addiction who were forced out onto the streets instead of invited into the hospital for treatment. And so my parents, in incredible feats of resourcefulness, were able to, you know, leave Brooklyn, move to the greener suburbs of Staten Island. They put me and my brother through school without any debt. They provided for their families, for their community. My father made New York Magazine's list of best doctor 8 years. Not in a row, but I think 8 years overall.
I mean, that's still pretty good.
Still pretty good. Yeah. He was really beloved amongst the people who knew him and still is. I mean, he's retired now, but he still is very admired. And so that sounds like the proverbial American dream. Mm-hmm. But that's not the full story. Because the fact of the matter is, the reason why my parents were able to come here was because in 1967, the civil rights movement, which was really built on the shoulders of Black men and Black women, advocated for a change to the immigration laws and passed the 1967 Immigration Act. And previous to 1967, the US actually had a law on the books that said that visas and green cards would be handed out in a way that preserved the homogeneity of North America, meaning the white majority.
And the nice way of saying it.
Yeah, it's a nice way of encoding white supremacy.
Right.
And after that, they decided to grant visas and green cards based on the labor needs of the country and family ties to existing immigrants. And so in the 60s and 70s, there was this fear of a doctor shortage in America. Mm-hmm. And so my parents, who came from very humble beginnings, who did not have a lot of wealth, were able to get their medical degrees in India because India has a socialized education system. And for people as poor as them, it cost, the family lore is, about $50 a semester to go to medical school.
Insane.
Yeah.
To think about. I mean, it's great. It's great. It's just awful how much it costs to go to school here.
Well, and that's what leads to the systemic racism and systemic oppression of people, because the U.S. immigration system, through that act of inclusion that eradicated white supremacy, began to take advantage of socialized education in other countries to fill their labor needs. And so And then when immigrants like my parents come here, Indians and Asians are often held up as a model minority and used as this straw man in an argument of white supremacy and anti-blackness to sort of point to Black and Latinx people and say, why can't you be more like these Asian Americans? But I believe that if the U.S. educated their population the way other countries educate theirs, you would see just as many Black and brown and Latinx doctors and engineers and lawyers in this country as you do in the Indian diaspora. And so when we're talking about the system, we need to be able to, you know, and being able to unmask the system for people when we tell our stories of success, this is what we need to do. We need to say, yes, these things happened where I worked hard and I had access to these opportunities. And that also contributed to my success. It was hard work plus access to opportunity.
Yeah, exactly. You can't pull yourself up by your bootstraps if you don't have bootstraps.
Yeah. And we say that like, okay, well, but the problem with the bootstrap analogy is that it makes it sound like an individual wasn't given something.
Mm.
Instead of how the system was designed to support certain individuals or certain types of people over others. And so the other example I often give is the fact that, you know, as a woman, I run a business and I have a book coming out and people have congratulated me on that and said, you must be working all the time. And I do work really hard. But the fact of the matter is I could not have started my business unless I had gotten married, not because my husband was independently wealthy, but because I was able to get on his health insurance. Mm-hmm. And having a second income gave us that little bit of a buffer that I needed to make this work. And then on top of it, you know, I don't have children. So during the pandemic, I wasn't spending my days homeschooling. And my husband has been supportive enough to do, you know, most or all of the housework.
Lucky.
yeah, super. I mean, super lucky, but also so many men enjoy that. Like so many straight men who have wives enjoy that. And it is considered so lucky when a woman gets it, which yes, both all of us who get that are lucky.
Yeah.
But that's also how the system is not really designed to support women being able to achieve at the level that men do.
Is a leader's ability to retell their own or tell their story of success enough though?
So I don't enough for what?
To advance equity, get us over, to make equity as important as diversity and inclusion.
I think it is the first step in getting there because it allows the leader to really understand their relationship to the system, because that's often the connection that's missing for most people. They're like, you're talking about the system, but how does this affect my life? And so this ability to reframe your story allows readers to connect to the system on a very personal level.
Yeah.
But then in order to advance it in the organization, we have to go back to what I was talking about before. What is understanding how your organization works? What opportunities are available for which people? And how do you open up those doors for more people?
Is a leader's ability to retell their story of success enough?
Enough for...
advancing equity, making it as important as diversity and inclusion.
So I think it's the first step because so often we are, you know, we talk about the system and I think people and particularly leaders have trouble understanding how this system connects to their personal narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And so it allows them to sort of embody this concept of equity in a much more reified way for themselves. But and also what it does is one of the most harmful things I think we're doing is sort of the gaslighting around bootstrapping theory or rugged individualism. And by reframing your success, what you are doing is you are ceasing to participate in this sort of, you know, universal practice of gaslighting that we all do when we say that it was just my hard work that got me here.
Yeah, definitely. Right?
You are at least in some way changing your behavior in a way that does advance equity, or at least the knowledge and the awareness of equity. And then after that, I think we need to go to the other points that I made about digging into how your organization works and creating communications that explain how the organization works for some and not for others and what you're going to do to remedy that. So it's a first step. It's, you know, but, you know, and equity, I think, is a lifelong goal. You know, when people say they want to solve their equity and inclusion problems, I'm like, that's like telling me you want to solve crime or accounting.
Yeah, it's like, I feel like everyone in DEI, it's like, we would love to not have to work on these things, but just being realistic, it's one of the things that we're constantly going to have to be working on. It's like, you know, you don't want to wish yourself out of a job, but it is something, you know, it's like, it would be great not to be have to work on this, but it is a, like, ever, like I said, ever evolving, ever growing and changing thing.
Yeah, I mean, we shouldn't see it as like, I mean, you can work yourself out of a job in terms of a specific problem that a mm-hmm. company may have, but to say that a company or is going to adopt diversity, equity, inclusion is really to say that you're trying to stand up a core business function. It mm-hmm. is like saying that you're going to adopt digital transformation. You don't just throw up a website and be like, all right, then we're done, right? Like, you're like, oh no, we need to hire people. This is something that needs to be stewarded. This is something that will continue to evolve.
Yes.
This is something that will continue to have threats against it. And mm-hmm. we need to continue to like steward it as well as protect against any threats to our digital transformation in order to be competitive in this marketplace. It's the same thing with equity and inclusion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so this idea that we should be working ourselves out of a job is also, I think, something that needs to be corrected because, you know, it's like saying to somebody like, you know, their financial books are a mess. You can hire somebody to fix your books, but that doesn't mean you're done with accounting. You know, like that's something that you need to continue to steward. And maybe you have a specialist that comes and fixes your book and then you hire somebody else to steward it. That's reasonable, but it is never going to be something that is just a, you know, a checklist of readiness and then you're done.
Yeah, it's definitely not a one and done. It is something that, you have to keep working at and keep, like you said, it just keeps evolving. I think of how back not too long ago, it was just HR was all that we really had. And this was all lumped mm-hmm. under HR before the whole concept of DEI D&I came out, and now, you know, adding equity as well. So it's ever evolving and constantly needs to be worked on to be maintained.
Mm-hmm.
So what, and you mentioned that, you know, in this effort, there's going to be constantly, you know, evolving and advancements, but also going to be obstacles. What's the biggest obstacle to designing more equitable organizations?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it probably comes down to two things. One, mm-hmm. which I mentioned, which is this really hardcore belief, particularly in America, around rugged individualism.
Could you expand on what rugged individualism is?
Sure. So rugged individualism is really the belief that one's success or failure is solely constructed by one's own effort.
Mm-hmm.
And to stop believing in that can be very threatening for Americans because, you know, a lot of times we talk about empowerment and agency and not having a victim mindset. And so we like to believe that everything is in our control. And to really let go of rugged individualism means that you have to reconcile yourself to the fact that not everything is in your control in life. And we don't like that. And this even gets to the equity thing, because really equity is in pursuit of justice. And, you know, I write about this in the book at one point that there is a theory in psychology called the just world theory, which is the way in which people explain why bad things happen. And often they use religion to do this. And I've seen this particularly as a Hindu. I've seen a lot of people misuse the concept of karma to explain why bad things happen.
That must drive you insane.
Yeah. And so it bugs me because they're not understanding why the intention behind the doctrine of karma. And then because the doctrine of karma is saying that the effort that you put forth today can affect your future. it does not mean that the corollary is true, meaning it does not mean that the circumstances that you are in now are a direct result of any past actions, whether in this life or in other lives, if you believe in reincarnation. And so the just world theory is saying that, like, this is how people try to explain what's happening. They want to believe we live in a just world and people get what they deserve. The problem with believing in a just world is that if you really start to, like, pull on that thread, what you realize is that in a just world, there can be no innocent victim.
And there's plenty of that in this world.
And there's plenty of that. And so to admit that somebody is an innocent victim is to admit that the world is not just. And that is very complicated for people, and people don't like to do that. And so we come up with lots of different ways to get around this. And this, and why that's so dangerous is because if we can't see an innocent victim, then we end up blaming the victim for whatever happens to them.
Yes, which is way too common.
Yeah. But it happens because of this belief in a just world. And what we really need to believe, what we really need to understand, is that even if we eradicated all the man-made injustices in this world, life would still be unjust because people die early.
Yes.
People get incurable diseases. You know, most people don't get what they deserve, either good or bad. And when you can admit to that, first, it'll break your heart.
Yeah.
But when it breaks your heart, it'll break it open. And you will start to have far more compassion for people and understand, oh, we need to design a system that allows people to experience injustice and still thrive. You know, there's a saying by Hafiz, who is a Middle Eastern, I believe, poet. And it's a saying that I have on my desktop screen that's, you know, the small man builds cages for everyone he knows, while the sage, who has to duck his head when the moon is low, keeps dropping keys all night long for the beautiful rowdy prisoners.
That's beautiful.
And like, and for me, that's equity. That's the pursuit of equity.
I'm just still thinking about the quote and the imagery. It's so beautiful. And It does sum it up really just beautifully.
Yeah. And so when we're, so to give up rugged individualism is to give up this belief in a just world. The second obstacle in organizations, I think, and well, in our society at large, and this is going to be probably a really radical thought, even for some DEI consultants.
We love radical thoughts here. how we learn and how we grow.
Yeah. You know, we have a real tendency to think that either when we employ someone or when we are employed by somebody, that the employer owns the employee. And that is not true. Like, when an employer pays you a salary, they are renting your talent for 40 hours a week.
Yes.
And if they pay you more, it doesn't mean they get more time, because really what we need to understand is time is the most limited and fundamental resource. Nobody, no matter how rich or powerful they are, can actually make more time. It is the most finite resource.
I think Jeff Bezos is working on that, though.
Yeah, I'm sure. But like, but you know, if you read the 1619 Project by Nicole Hannah-Jones, she talks about, or I don't think it was her, she edited the piece. I think it was another writer who writes about how, you know, we tend to believe that management manuals came out of the Industrial Revolution and the assembly line, but actually the first management manuals came out of slavery. And this idea of how to squeeze the most productivity out of a human being at the lowest cost. And that is such a fundamental belief to how we design our organizations. Yeah. And that belief an assumption needs to be challenged and innovated on. We need to find a way that says, no, we're not going to try to, because, you know, there are two types of power really in the world. There's supremacist power and there's liberatory power. Supremacist power, in the most concise way, is taking more than one share. Mm-hmm. It is extraction and domination and oppression. Liberatory power is a form of power that exists in relationships on mutual trust and respect, and the belief that by working together, you know, sort of the whole is greater than the sum of its parts, right? Like, we could do something really amazing here if everybody felt respected and trusted and valued. And so if we really want to design equitable organizations, we really need to rethink this concept of employment, the way we write jobs, you know, like, if this job requires more than 40 hours a week, then it is more than one person's job.
That's a really great point. I've never thought about it that way.
You know, and so that is such a fundamental concept that rubs against sort of the more predatory form of capitalism. Now, I'm not an anti-capitalist. I believe that some fields should not be affected by capitalism, like healthcare and education. I believe in, you know, like, obviously my parents benefited from socialized education. My parents, as physicians, are advocates for universal healthcare. But I don't think that anti-capitalism works for every field, right? Like, and the reason I don't believe that is because the reason my parents left India is because India had a socialized economy when they left, and there was no opportunity for them. America offered something through its capitalist structure that India could not. And so I really believe that we need both, that we need to understand which fields should be fields that generate revenue and profits, and which fields should have other measurements such as societal impact, and be able to have some wisdom in how we design these organizations. Like, not everything should be run by an MBA, right?
Yeah.
So, but that being said, I think we do need to fundamentally think about, within this capitalist structure, how can we practice, like, a capitalism that is based on actually valuing human beings and human lives and human creativity, something that cannot be outsourced to computers, rather than a capitalism that is predatory and based really on either slavery or colonialism and the desire to extract resources.
Definitely. I was just thinking of back in when I mean, it's not a comparison at all. Like, I just think of when, like, in the idea of getting modern free labor from capitalism, like the internship that I did in New York after after college, doing an unpaid internship in New York City is just like the most, you know, and you're like, you're doing it to get your foot in the door and, like, you know, make these connections that will eventually get you a job, but you're still gonna work 40 hours a week for free. Mm-hmm. And it's like, and you're gonna be happy for it. You competed for that. Mm-hmm. It was such a weird thing to think about now. And I completely agree with you about the mix of, you know, what should do with capitalism and then socialized things, because I've had friends whose family is like yours, who are doctors and physicians in, like, a lot of Scandinavian countries where things are more socialized, who do come here for those opportunities. So in my opinion, anything that's a basic human right, like healthcare and education, that should be, you know, that should be more socialized. That should be available to everybody.
Well, and those are also cost centers that then benefit the workforce, right?
Yeah.
Like, those have long-term impacts that allow for a healthier, more, like, productive workforce, a more talented workforce, a more educated workforce. Like, those eventually end up benefiting companies. And so, and really what this gets at, like, and this is sort of the problem with rugged individualism, mm-hmm. too, is that we then don't understand interdependence. Like, all of these fields are interdependent.
Yes.
You know, and so what we do in one affects the other. And that doesn't mean that the economic model that we adopt for one should then be, you know, dictated as being adopted for the other ones, right? Like, yeah. It is possible to say that, you know what, healthcare and education are going to be socialized, but these other fields like, you know, technological development mm-hmm. are going to be, you know, capitalized fields. Right. And it's not going to be a predatory form of capitalism, but it is going to be, you know, a marketplace competition based yes. form of capitalism. Right.
Yeah.
And so like, yeah, we need that combination to really, because really what we're talking about here in DEI is balancing out sovereignty and interdependence. Right.
Yes.
How do we design for the collective good while still preserving an individual's right to self-govern themselves and make decisions that are in their own best interest?
Definitely. Right? Yeah. Yeah. I think still acknowledging everyone's individuality and differences.
Yeah. That like what you may need and what I may need may differ, and I should have the right to pursue what I need and you should have the right to pursue what you need. And yet at the same time, we need to be mindful about how those decisions affect one another.
Yes. I think of that. I'm sure you've seen the cartoon with the three boys trying to watch baseball over a fence.
Yeah.
And the first one is just like, yeah, this is what happens. And they're different heights. And, you know, this is like, you know, with, you know, if you give them all the same mm-hmm. and be like, hey, we're good. You know, the tallest one will still be able to see, you know, a lot better than the shortest one who still can't see, but is a little bit closer. So yeah, definitely acknowledging different people's different needs is so important.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And speaking of, like, you just mentioned tech companies, you work with a lot of media companies. Like, what's the role the media plays in DEI?
Yeah. I mean, first, I love working with media companies. They're like some of my favorite clients. And, you know, Mahzarin Banaji, who is one of the researchers who the original researchers on implicit bias, has this saying that bias is the thumbprint of culture on the brain. And I found myself writing in the book that if bias is the thumbprint of culture on the brain, then media are the ink pad. Media is how many, if not most, of our biases are coded. And so the reason I love working with media companies is because when you can get a media organization to really commit to DEI and start to embed an equity lens in their content creation, then the impact is above and beyond the organization, because that affects how society sees the world.
Yes,
you
have a lot of influence.
Yeah, they have a lot of influence and power. And the reason, you know, like, I worked actually at Sesame Workshop, which is the nonprofit behind Sesame Street.
Yeah, that's adorable.
Yeah. Well, it was adorable, and it was some of the most intelligent social scientists I had ever met working
yes.
at that company. You know, like, they really take social science and embed it into the programming. And they were able to do remarkable things. They created an HIV positive Muppet in South Africa called Cammy in order to help kids understand that you're not going to catch HIV by playing with another child with HIV. Like, they change the way a generation sees an illness. Right?
Yeah.
And that's what media can do, is it can change the way a generation sees something. It can help us all to develop a more inclusive and equitable lens on how we see our fellow American or our fellow countrymen. And so I think media is exceptionally powerful in what we're doing here.
I couldn't agree more. And I think that's so amazing. The working with Sesame Workshop, and yeah, the amount of, they do such amazing work in getting children to understand DEI and like, to the point where they're, you know, no, like, they're more comfortable than their adult parents because of things like the various Muppets that they've introduced, and the amount of social science that must go into that is, I've never thought about it, but it must be staggering.
Yeah. And I also think they demonstrate how to sort of model also learning and changing, because in the early days, Jim Henson was Very, it was, I mean, it wasn't a hard and fast rule, but he wasn't really in favor of having Muppets that had like skin tone colors. And so when, you know, the show would be, you know, built in these other countries, and Sesame Workshop had a great model where they didn't believe in cultural imperialism and just taking Elmo and Big Bird everywhere. They would actually work with production teams in country to develop, you know, characters that were native and representative of that culture and could address the issues in that culture. But they would still sort of toe this line that Jim Henson have of like, let's, you know, usually we don't use skin tones as the Muppet color. And then recently there was an announcement that Sesame Workshop has introduced two Muppets, a black man and and his son.
Yeah, I saw that.
That are clearly supposed to be black. And so, you know, the show is willing to evolve and learn and understand that, like, what was true back in the 70s and 80s is not good policy now, and that we need to be able to actually address more address race more directly. And then they had a recent show where Amanda Gorman was the host of, I think it's called Race and Racism. And it was just so fabulous. It was so well done. I think I watched maybe half of it, but it was, I was just so impressed in how they were able to get kids to talk about, well, this is my skin color, and talking to their parents about their skin color, and mixed families, and, you know, separating out race and racism and what it really means. And, you know, when I see that, I'm like, yeah, okay, well, if we can do that with children's television, then we can do something much more impactful with adult television.
Definitely.
You know,
I mean, I think about like how a show like Will and Grace made such an impact in the LGBTQ community. And even, I mean, if you go back and look at it now, yeah, there were problematic things, just like everything from the 90s or from that time period. But it did make such a huge impact on people's views on LGBTQ plus people. And really really increased people's acceptance of LGBT people, just seeing them as, you know, just like normal people, just like, you know.
Yeah, I think that it does a lot for acceptance. And yeah, there's always problems with it, but I'm reminded of, you know, Laverne Cox produced this documentary called Transparent about, was it called Transparent?
I was going to say Transparency is a show.
No. It was called Disclosure.
Okay.
I think. I can't remember. Google Laverne Cox documentary.
But Transparent did do a lot to increase trans visibility.
That's what this documentary by Laverne Cox did too. It was, but it was a documentary about the representation of transgender people in media. And one person sort of very smartly said, she's like, you know, when we talk about these sort of awkward or flawed representations, the answer to that is just more representation. If you have more representation of trans people of color, of, you know, every marginalized community, then the occasional awkward one or the one that gets it wrong, like the stakes are not so high. It doesn't become such a big deal. One movie doesn't have to do everything for everybody from that marginalized identity then, you know? And so that's really, and that's sort of also the growth in media is like, you know, there's been this sort of like thing that, like, you know, all the stories have been told. And I was like, well, maybe all the, you know, cisgender white male stories have been told, but there's all these other stories that we haven't told yet from all these other cultures. And so there's so much more media to create and to consume and to enjoy if we could just, you know, open our, you know, widen our aperture and see like humanity with all of its diversity and be able to tell these stories from the perspective of the protagonist and not with a white gaze or a male gaze or a heterosexual gaze.
Yes. I mean, I couldn't agree more. And yeah, not all the stories have been told. This is like all the easily marketable ones have been told.
Yeah.
there's a lot more stories that, you know, are being actively not told because of fear of like angering some, you know, some group.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. So my most favorite author is Arundhati Roy, who wrote The God of Small Things and won the Booker Prize for it. And she has this quote that I love that says, maybe not verbatim, but it says, there's no such thing as the voiceless. There is only the intentionally silenced or the preferably unheard.
Yes.
And I'm like, yeah, like
It's so profound.
all of those voices that are being ignored or silenced are the ones that need a platform now.
Thank you so much, Manal, for coming and having this conversation with me. I said, I who've been in the industry not for for just about 4 years, so not super long, but learned so much from this conversation. So thank you so much. And I hope our listeners, and I'm sure our listeners will learn just as much as I did. And I, again, thank you so much for coming in and having this conversation with me.
No, thank you, Ben, for inviting me into this space. I think the Forum for Workplace Inclusion has always been on the forefront of this work and and has just been an incredible resource to me as a practitioner. And so I am grateful to be able to contribute to this community and happy if anybody is interested, if they want to reach out, I'm happy to have a conversation with anybody.
Great. And where can they find your book?
Yes, so the book is out. You can find it on Amazon and Barnes and Noble, as well as bookshop.org, which is a site that works with independent bookstores if your preference leans that way. You can also go to my website, theequitybook.com, which has buttons for you to click to go buy the book, but it also has an equity toolkit. It has my bookshelf with like recommendations, it has videos, it has lots of interactive stuff. So you can check that out as well.
Awesome. Well, yeah, definitely check out those wonderful resources. And again, thank you, Manal, and thank you to all our listeners.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Manal, for that wonderful podcast and for being part of our 2021 series. And thank you to our listeners, and a special thank you to our sponsor, Best Buy. To learn more about strategic communication and storytelling, visit brevityandwit.com or reach Manal directly at manal@brevityandwit.com. New episodes of the Forum podcast are available at forumworkplaceinclusion.org/podcast. You can also find our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Anchor, and Stitcher. Thank you again for listening and have a great day.
Thank you again for listening to the Forum and Workplace Inclusion podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast to get updates and the latest episodes. Also, tell us what you think by reviewing our podcast. We'd love to hear your feedback. For more information, visit us at forumworkplaceinclusion.org or search Workplace Forum on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Thank you very much and have a great day. The Forum on Workplace Inclusion podcast is recorded at Augsburg University in Minneapolis, Minnesota. One of the most diverse private colleges in the Midwest, Augsburg University offers more than 50 undergraduate majors and 9 graduate degrees to 3,400 students of diverse backgrounds at its campus in the vibrant center of the Twin Cities and nearby Rochester, Minnesota location. Augsburg educates students to be informed citizens, thoughtful stewards, critical thinkers, and responsible leaders. An Augsburg education is defined by excellence in the liberal arts and professional studies, guided by the faith and values of the Lutheran Church, and shaped by its urban and global settings. Learn more at augsburg.edu.